Good morning, science. My name is Alexandra McGold, and today I am speaking with Professor Adriano Aguzzi from the University of Zurich, where he is the director of the Institute of Neuropathology. He is a prion expert. He and his team have deciphered how prions actually make it from the gut all the way to the brain, where they are using lots of different cells to get there and different factors to be able to replicate. On top of that, they were able to pinpoint the naturally occurring function of the protein, as well as a vulnerable part that can be targeted by antibodies. They were also able to create a B-cell-based platform that will come up with a whole lot of naturally occurring antibodies that will be tremendously helpful in a whole slew of different diseases. On top of this, Adriano Aguzzi is also very active on social media and is never one to shy away from a critical discussion.
What is the favorite aspect of your work? When do you feel you're in your element?
I mean, actually, I like everything. It's very hard to sort out what I like best, because in reality, I enjoy every day and every minute of what I do. It's my work is very varied. It also has changed a lot over the years. Like, I think it's probably normal that when you start off as a student, as a postdoc, you do all the experiments yourself, and this can also be a lot of fun. And then, you know, then you grow into the role of a mentor, and then you have your own students whom you help to develop their scientific personality, and that's also wonderful. And then over time, you go even further. I founded the MD-PhD program at my university. I've directed it for 20 years, and I have to say that, so these are the students who, you know, they don't work in my lab. I mean, some of them do work in my lab, but most actually work in other labs. And for me, it's also great to interact with them, to find out what they are doing, what it is that their passion is, and also advise them. And all of these things are actually wonderful. And this goes beyond what probably... you know, what I mean, I think that's a kind of cliche, which is not really a cliche. I mean, it's perfectly right. That, when you, that as a scientist, the most exciting thing is when you are confronted with a new discovery, with something that unexpected and exciting, and that opens up a new avenue. But in reality, I think that our job is much more than that. And the discoveries, yes, they are wonderful, but they are not so frequent. So I think you also need to enjoy all the other things. And so if you ask me, what is it that I don't enjoy? That's perhaps, why not? And frankly, I have a hard time. I would have a hard time really telling you because there is really nothing that, where I would say, I hate it. Maybe I'm privileged, I'm certainly privileged. But the fact is, I mean, particularly now, I'm having the time of my life.
So you have made incredible discoveries. When you're looking back from your own personal viewpoint, what was the most amazing Eureka moment?
You know, it's I'm not sure I made these incredible discoveries. I think that maybe there is always a disconnect between looking at things from the outside and being actually in the middle of it. I always have a feeling of that actually that I didn't do well enough, maybe this is also a driver. I think that this happens to a lot of scientists. Certainly a part of it is the imposter syndrome, and the imposter syndrome can be debilitating, but it can also be a motivator to as long as it doesn't become horrible. But I think a little bit of imposter syndrome is actually not bad, because it tells you, okay, it prevents you from resting on your laurels, and that's actually a good thing. but within reason. I think that I really went through several phases. I think I was a bit of a late bloomer in after medical school. I went into the specialty training as a neuropathologist, and the first 3 years were remarkably unsuccessful. And part of it was certainly that I was not in an environment that was very rigorously scientific, but part of it was certainly my fault. I just didn't recognize that if I want to make things happen, I have to actually take my own destiny in my own hands. That was not very successful. I got my specialty training. I became kind of a professional in my field, which is all very good, but scientifically not much was going on. And then actually one thing happened that could have been a disaster, but actually it was luck in disguise. At that time, I'm talking about the mid 80s, Switzerland was not a member of the European Union. It still isn't, but there were no treaties, no bilateral treaties, no nothing. It was for me as an Italian to be in Switzerland was just like if I had been for any other third part of the country. And the rules those days was if you can come and be a postdoc or a medical doctor or something, but after 3 years you have to go. The only problem is I didn't know about that. After 2.5 years, I got this letter, registered letter from the cantonal police telling me that I have exactly 6 months to pack my things and go.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I was not expecting that. So it was dramatic, and I had clearly to find something to do. At the same time, I guess that if that had not happened, I would have chosen the road of least resistance. I would have simply stayed there and do my things. And so, and in fact, what happened was that, okay, fine. Now I really have to think about what to do with my life. And at that time, to me, it was clear that I wanted to get into a better research environment. At that time, I had met a guy called Erwin Wagner, who was, in those days, transgenic mice were all the rage. This was the early days of transgenics. And Erwin was pretty much at the forefront of that, was making a lot of transgenic mice, expressing all kinds of oncogenes in different places. And he needed a pathologist because he couldn't, he was a very good molecular biologist, but he couldn't really read the histology of tissues. And that's what I had been doing for 3 years. So essentially that was my entry ticket into the Wagner lab. I had no idea of how to do molecular biology. I was completely naive, but I could do the pathology, and this was something that was needed in that lab. That was how actually I got in, and then I spent 3 years there, and it was incredibly successful. We had some very nice papers, and very exciting, very international, also very good science, and that was at the Institute of Molecular Pathology in Vienna, So in a way, I was kicked out of Switzerland, but in the end, it was luck in disguise because we all know, you have been in so many countries and you have traveled a lot, and mobility for academia is absolutely necessary, and it is necessary because it opens your views, it opens it broadens your horizon, it allows you to not only to learn new techniques but also new cultures, new ways of doing science. So mobility is really important. At that time I knew nothing of that. I was forced to be mobile, And that was a great thing, actually. And so I spent these 3 years in Vienna, and then it was very successful. So in the end, the people in Switzerland wanted me back. And so at that time, I was a bit more, let's say, less naive. And I said, okay, fine. I mean, I'm happy to come back as an attending physician, but I want a long-term contract because do it, and that's what I got eventually. And at that time, so together with Erwin, we made actually the first mouse model for the development of gliomas. It was a transgenic mouse that expressed an oncogene in astrocytes. That was great, while we were still in Vienna, I met Charles Weissman, who had just cloned the prion gene, again Charles wanted me to do pathology for him, so we immediately hit it off, and it was fantastic. And then we worked together for several years, for several decades, actually. And Charles Weissman was clearly one of the foremost molecular biologists of our times, and so for me it was an incredible privilege, he really adopted me. He spent so much time teaching me things, to have a mentor of that quality, Charles was a guy who invented site-directed mutagenesis. He cloned interferons. He cloned the protein. He founded Biogen. I mean, he was an entrepreneur as well. Exceptional person. And at that time, I started setting up my own lab. But I also realized that very quickly that. If I don't get an advisor, somebody who kind of guides me in terms of really choosing good scientific projects, it would be very unlikely that I would be successful. And Charles really took it over to really advise me all the time. And we spent many, many days from morning to evening discussing science. Things started going very well because I should say this was also the right moment because back in those days, prions were exotic. It was a very strange thing which nobody really understood. And then all of a sudden the mad cow disease crisis hit, and then all of a sudden everybody was interested in prions. And then we could progress very quickly. There was a lot of money available. There was a lot of very good students, very good postdoc, because everybody thought it was exciting. So it became a thriving field, and that was sheer luck, because I was obviously doing the right things at the right moment. Luck has a prepared mind. Obviously I tried to make the best out of it, but one has to say, it was it could have gone sideways, so that was good.
Yeah, that's a very humble way of saying this. So you said you also enjoy to see what your former kids, so to say, are passionate about with their own labs. Do you have a feeling that they're passionate about the right things? Do you share?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I have to say that by now, 13 of my alumni are now tenured professors in many places in the US and in Europe. And first of all, this fills me with pride. Actually, I think that having trained such wonderful scientists and seeing them being successful is at least as important as writing nice papers or having successful discoveries or so. I think that's very, very important. So I'm very, very pleased about that. I also have to say that a lot of them are women. It was never for me a policy to support specifically women, but you know, I had wonderful female colleagues and who were very talented, and of course I helped them. But you know, they made their own career out of their own strength. But in the end, I have to say that you know, at our medical faculty, female professors are less than 10%, but of those who have become professors out of my lab, almost half are women, and most of them are mothers and have children and have created also a family. So in the end, I stress this because you know, there is a lot of posturing and a lot of virtue signaling, and so I've never cared for this. But the facts are that I have always supported women, and in the end, the facts are more important than the words, I think, at least.
Nice. So, as I warned you, one of my favorite questions to ask is when you have people where you clearly feel that they could go on forever, they have a million ideas, if there were absolutely no limitations, if the fairy came and you had all the money in the world and all the workforce and absolutely no time limits, what are a couple of questions that you would want to tackle?
Well, if I could do whatever I want to do with any limitation, yes, I would do exactly what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the thing with the limitation is, you know, my goal in life, or my goal as a scientist, is not to become the master of the universe. I have never wanted to be the head of a large research institution, and in fact I had this opportunity. I mean, when it's no secret, I can talk freely about this. When the Germans created the German DZNE, the German Center for Neurodegeneration Research, with a budget of more than 60 million euro. Per year, I was asked to be the director of this thing, I looked at it carefully, and after a couple of weeks it became totally clear to me that this was not what I wanted, and that I would be much better off with a budget that would be less than 5% of that, and run a lab with a bunch of students and postdocs. And for me, I have to say that sitting at a table with a bunch of students and looking at some Western blots, that's my idea of bliss. I mean, that's that's what I love to do, and to look at experiments, to get excited about some strange bands that come up, to suggest the next experiment. These young people, they are so clever. They are they know a lot of things that I don't. They teach me stuff. They keep me on my toes, and they keep me young. And nice. So that's so much better than spending your days in a budget meeting with some administrators. I mean, sure. Come on. I mean, it's not even close.
But I think I'm going to ask you the same question in a different way. So okay. Imagine everything goes well, and hopefully a long, 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 long time from now, all of us go to heaven, but in 200 years, you get a chance to go back to Earth for one day. What's the question that you would Google the answer to first? What scientific question would you want to find out?
I am going to to sneak out of this question again. And the reason is because, in the end, if you look at something, if you are passionate about science, everything mm-hmm. is equally interesting. You know, mm-hmm. of course, I do prions. I mean, of course, I love prions. Sure. But, you know, the thing is that epigenetics is just as interesting. And, you know, I mean, whatever you do, you can become passionate about it. So, mm-hmm. So for me, the question is not so much... yes, of course, there are a couple of things in my mind that I would really like to sort out, and I will. Yes. I mean, you know, I'm totally hell bent on that. I mean, I will sort them out. And on the other hand, again, I mean, it's a matter of what happens during the arc of a lifetime. At this stage of my career, I am more interested in things that can be used by the community to do interesting stuff. So it's no longer about me publishing the next Nature paper or so. It's, of course, I mean, that is nice. It would be nice. I'm not publishing any papers in Nature, but, you know, it'd be nice if it happened. But actually, the more important thing for me at this stage is to create, for example, to create methodologies, technologies that will outlive. And so, for example, we are doing now something with CRISPR, which is extremely ambitious and entails the creations of dozens of thousands of plasmids. And so we have invented technologies to make plasmids, to clone plasmids in very high throughput. And so these are things that, of course, are going to help my research. The real reason why I start this stuff is because I want them to help the research of many other scientists, which could be completely unrelated to what I'm doing. And that is something that I would have never considered doing 20 years ago. But I think that in the final phase of my career, it's something where which to me is actually more important than getting churning out the next paper and the next paper. Although, of course, that has to go on as well. You know, we're not naive. I mean, producing results and writing about them, and so that's a part of our job. But I see things actually a bit in a broader perspective now. And again, I think it's something that is really related to the phase in life where one stands.
So in a way, you're coming full circle to where your early mentor was,
absolutely. No, I think that I think it is exactly what is happening.
Professor Agudzi, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, it was wonderful. Thank you.